We're going all the way back to the fall and winter of 1976 for this one. I know, I'm old. And granted, it's an old story, I promise you, it's a good one. And in the summer of 76, my stupid self decided to move out to California. It was a well-meaning venture, I assure you, but a failed one in every conceivable aspect. I'd moved back to Arkansas less than a year after I moved out there, in a place like home, I suppose. But it also might have had something to do with a roommate I had when I was living in Sacramento. I was kind of a latecomer to the hippie movement, too young for the Summer of Love or the Vietnam protests, but seeing what the war did to my old man was just awful. I was young, real young when he came back, but I remember how different he was, just like a little piece of him was lost over there somehow. So it wasn't until the mid-70s that I got a wild hair up my butt to move out to San Francisco. My old man said he'd give me $100 in bus money if I stayed in high school long enough to graduate. So I did, and that same summer I headed out to San Fran on a Greyhound bus. Only I didn't quite make it. I stopped to see a guy I used to go to camp with in Sacramento and, well, just sort of stayed there. His parents offered me their spare room until I had enough money to carry on to Frisco, but living there made me feel like a bum. So, after squirreling away my first two paychecks, I decided to move into a shared apartment with two strangers. I meet up with a landlord at the house in question. We do a little walk around, and he shows me where I'll be staying. The place was really nice. Three separate bedrooms, two bathrooms, and all the ground floor facilities you could imagine. Kitchen, laundry room, TV room, garage, and the rent was enticingly low considering it was such a nice place. Both guys who lived there were out at work at the time, so I didn't get to meet any of them in advance, and obviously I wasn't permitted to nosy around in either of their bedrooms, so I really didn't get a sense of their personalities. But boy, was that about to change fast. A week later, I moved into the free room and met the two guys I'd be living with. One guy was named Richard, and the other guy was named Brad. Richard seemed kind of weird and untidy, but he seemed to mostly keep to himself, while Brad was much more friendly and outgoing. The thing was, Brad was moving out at some point over the following 2 weeks, and he wanted to give me the skinny on Richard before he left. Basically, he asked me how badly I needed the room. I told him real bad. It was either there or be homeless for the foreseeable future. And that's when he tells me that Richard can be cool when he wants to be, but he's definitely a few cards short of a full deck. I asked him what he means by that, and he just replies, "You'll see. Just keep your eye out for other apartments. The B generally has some good listings." At first, I just figured I'd waded into some slightly bitter roommate rivalry or politics, and I wanted nothing to do with it. I wasn't about to take sides after having been there for a grand total of 5 minutes, so I decided to play it diplomatically. But Brad was right. Richard was really weird, and not even weird in a fun, hippie way. He wasn't just waving his freak flag high, man. He was the freak flag, all on his own. First time I noticed was when I walked into the kitchen and Richard was sat at the table, reading a newspaper while holding an orange on top of his head. I asked him what he was doing, and he replied something like, "Absorbing vitamin C." I laughed, thinking he was just being silly, but when I turned to look at him, deadpan, the guy was deadly serious. I start explaining that's not how nutrition works, and he responds by telling me not to lecture him on what goes on in his body, how it was his body and he knew best about it. Naturally, I'm just like, "Okay, dude, whatever you say," being as non-confrontational as possible, but the second I saw Brad, I conceded that he was right. Richard was crazy. Just how crazy, I had no idea, but I was sure about to find out. Richard's behavior remained curiously strange until the time that Brad moved out. It wasn't anything too scary, just stuff that made you roll your eyes or shake your head. Like at one point, we're eating dinner in front of the TV, and Richard kind of sits up, stares into space for a moment, checks his own pulse, then says, "My heart just stopped beating." Brad seemed to have learned his lesson how to deal with such insane behavior because he falsely expresses some mild concern before suggesting Richard go take a nap, which he then does. Like some hypochondriac child, he finished his dinner, then goes to take a nap to alleviate his... what? His dead heart? I have no idea. Like I said, it wasn't scary, just kind of annoying. All the scary stuff came after Brad moved out. In fact, I think Brad was the only thing keeping a lid on Richard's behavior, because the same day Brad leaves is the same day Richard took a turn for the worse. So, like I've mentioned, I was working part-time in Sacramento, working 5-hour shifts, 4 days a week over at a nearby grocery store. One day I get back from my shift, and Richard is standing over the bathroom sink, looking into a piece of broken mirror he'd propped up against the counter, and he's shaving all his hair off with a straight razor.
"New haircut, buddy?"
I remember asking him. "No, it's my skull. I think it's fractured."
"Well, better get down to the hospital, Dickie boy. I hear those can be quite serious."
I'd pretty much adopted Brad's approach wholesale by that point, kindly acknowledge and then disengage. But Richard responds by telling me that not only is his skull fractured, but that he can feel the plates moving around under his skin. Now, I'm no doctor, but I was 99% sure that that was impossible. And when I took a look at his request, there was no bruising, no blood, nothing. He's just having another one of his hypochondriac health scares. One time we're having dinner and Richard dropped me a compliment on my sausage gravy. It was like a double compliment, since it was my mom's secret recipe too. Turns out Brad was right. Richard could be nice when he wanted to be. But then he somehow managed to ruin the moment by saying something like,
"Yeah, you're a real good cook. Much better than my mom. She used to try and poison me."
Again, like the thing with the orange, I thought he was cracking a joke, so I laughed. But just like the thing with the orange, he simply stares at me, totally straight-faced, and I realized that it wasn't a joke. Only this time he's actually kind of offended that I didn't take him seriously, and that's the first time I saw Richard's mean side come out. He just stared at me, holding his knife and fork so hard his fists were shaking, and for a moment, I was actually scared he was just going to lunge at me from across the table. Instead, he picks up his plate, clears it, then marches off up to his room. A few hours later, he apologized for being so rude. I forgave him, and thus the cycle began anew. He'd act perfectly normal, then some weird outbursts would have me reconsidering Brad's suggestion on keeping an eye out for a new apartment. But until I could get more hours at the Safeway, that just wasn't an option for me. If you remember, I moved into the apartment during the fall, and Rich's behavior had been, at worst, amusingly bizarre for the majority of my stay. But the closer and closer we got to Christmas, the more he seemed to be slipping further and further into some downward spiral, and it had turned out to be one he'd never fully recover from, and it was definitely one that was made entirely worse by our use of recreational drugs. Like I said, late blooming hippie here, so when Richard suggested we get our hands on some pot and LSD, I just thought, groovy, you know? I didn't stop to consider that might be a terrible idea given his psychological issues. I actually kind of thought drugs might help him, but good lord did that turn out to be total naivety. Like I said, I thought a trip or two might help Richard out, give him a little perspective, but using drugs just sparked some sort of fire in him. He didn't just use them recreationally like me and my buddies had back in Little Rock. He used them habitually. He tripped every night for a week, until I literally had to hide the little eyedropper of acid I'd bought for us. And when he finally came out of it, he was all kinds of messed up. The day after he sobered up, I heard him coming down for breakfast, and when he walks into the kitchen area, and I look up, I see he's as naked as the day he was born. Obviously, I'm like, screaming, "Richard, put on some clothes for Christ's sake." He just responds with, "Why?" Grabs some cereal, pours himself a bowl, then just sits down to eat. I was just getting progressively insanely more uncomfortable, and I couldn't bring myself to eat in front of a naked man like that, so I just got up and walked out. Huge mistake. Because I didn't properly address the whole nudity thing, he took that as him having a free pass. So, with an infuriatingly ever-increasing frequency, I'd have my roommate stumbling around the house, totally nude, while taking pulls on a bottle of Jack Daniels. Now, most people I've told this story to, they have said that they'd have been gone the moment the nudity thing started. But what can I say? It was the 70s. I was something of a freak myself. And if I couldn't handle one little weirdo in Sacramento, how was I going to stomach rubbing shoulders with hardcore Frisco hippies once I made it out there? Nope. Instead, the final straw was coming home to find him making cocktails. So like I said, I walk into the house one day and I hear the blender in the kitchen whirring. I wait for the break in the whirring to call out to him as I walk into the TV room. You had to walk that way to get to the kitchen, asking him what he's making. He just replies, "Cocktails," in this dull, flat tone that let me know that he was wasted. But when I enter the kitchen, I get this strong odor of whiskey, along with something else. Following whatever he'd been doing, Richard had evidently made this very out-of-character attempt to clean up after himself. But he hadn't been completely thorough, as on the plain white countertop, I could still make out what looked like streaks of some thick red liquid. I walk over, run my finger over a patch of it, rubbing it together between my fingers before feeling that it has a distinctly sticky texture to it.
"Richard,"
I said,
"is this blood?"
"No," he replied. Suddenly I get this sudden urge to lift up the lid of the trash can, but at the same time, I'm also filled with dread. Whatever, or whoever that blood belonged to, there'd surely be remnants of it in the trash. In fact, upon seeing a small, bloody fingerprint on the trash can's lid, I'm sure that's where I'd find the remains. Then, of course, I open the trash to see a bloody paper bag with what was clearly a stripy raccoon tail sticking out of it. During the mother of all arguments that followed, when I asked him what in God's name he was doing, he tried to palm me off with an excuse I've never, ever forgotten. He briefly stops the blender from whirring and says, "It's going to stop my heart from shrinking." Then carries on grinding up this reddy brown mess of soda, ice, and what I could only assume was raccoon meat. This crazy monster thought he had some rare medical condition where his heart was basically wasting away, and the cure was to blend the organ meats of trapped animals with Jack Daniels and Coca-Cola, of all things. Like I said, that was the final straw, and by that time, another guy was living there with us too. We discussed giving Richard a kind of ultimatum, either shape up or ship out. But considering he'd reached the butchering animals and eating them raw stage of his madness, we agreed the best thing was for us to just get out of there. I called my old camp buddy that night and begged my way back into his parents' spare room. I carried on working at the Safeway for a time, got some more hours, and since I wasn't paying rent in my buddy's parents' place, getting some bus money and a security deposit was much easier. I didn't hear no more of Richard, and when I finally left San Francisco in January of 77, I never looked back. Cut to just over 2 years later, I think about March of 1979. I'm living back with my parents in Little Rock, and I've cleaned up my act, and I'm working at another grocery store with my mind set on applying to colleges. Sometimes I used to get up real early and head down to the grocery store at around 6:30 a.m. to help the owner prep for opening hours, and a real small part of that was unpacking and arranging newspapers near the smaller front counter. I used to kind of take my time with this particular job on occasion, sipping my coffee, flicking through the sports section, all away from the prying eyes of the owner who was counting cash or whatever in his office. One morning, I catch a headline in, I think was the National Enquirer, saying something like, "Cannibal killer's trial date set." Obviously, that's not the sort of headline you read every day, so I start reading the article to get more details. And guess whose name I see, just a few lines down? Yep, my insane, crazy old roommate, Richard Chase. There's even a little picture of him in the margin, and clear as day, it's him. Same guy I lived with for the better part of 5 months. This is all from memory, so you'd have to ask Google for all the details, but here's what I remember. After I left the home I shared with Richard, his condition worsened and worsened over the course of the year, until finally in the winter of 77, he commits his first murder by randomly shooting a guy in the street. A few weeks later, he tries a home invasion, only the family isn't home, so he can't hurt anyone, so he decides to wait. But when they do get home, he gets the heebie-jeebies, turns tail, and runs. The family then arrives home to find that Richard had broken into their baby's nursery before going to the bathroom on the kid's clothes. He was absolutely sick in the head. A short time later, he tries another home invasion, and this time, he kills a pregnant woman. But here's the really messed up part. Before sleeping with her corpse, I read he put dog feces in the poor girl's mouth too. It makes you wonder what goes through a man's head to do something as absolutely insane as that. I followed the case for a while after, and I was happy when I heard he got the death penalty for the things he did. He ended up taking his own life before they could get him to the gas chamber, though. Figured he wanted to go out on his own terms. Only thing that messes with me is that some people say he wasn't crazy, that he knew what he was doing when he killed those women and did those awful things to them. I'm not saying he didn't deserve to die. That's not what I'm saying at all. Heck, I'd even kick the chair out from under that guy in a hot minute if he gave me the chance. But the only thing that's crazy is saying that he ain't. You understand me? I live with that man. I ate with him. I tripped with him. I know Richard Chase. And the cheese slid off that boy's crackers a long time before he started killing. He was crazy as a dog in a hubcap factory, the whole time I knew him. And although what he did was a tragedy, I wasn't entirely surprised by it. I feel lucky to have gotten out when I did. Hang around for another year and it might have been me getting shot dead at the side of the road. But the thing that really sticks with me isn't the survivor guilt, or whatever people want to call it. It's wondering how evil like that even comes into this world. I used to live with the biggest idiot on the face of the earth. Hector was this 6-foot Afro-Latino dude from New Jersey who had two distinct modes of being. Either he was a tornado of anger, or he was manically laughing at something. Rarely was there any in between. When you caught him in his laughing mood, he was tolerable at best, but catch him in one of his angry moods and he was totally unbearable. He was a roadie for some post-hardcore band that toured up and down the East Coast a bunch, which was one of the few good things about being his roommate. The fact that he spent weeks away at a time from the apartment but still paid rent. But whenever he was home, well, here's an example. It's July in East Harlem. I have the windows open. Latin brass band music is flowing through the afternoon air from some other open window, and I'm sipping Southern Peach lemonade like life is good. Out of nowhere, Hector bursts into the apartment, covered in brick dust, like,
"I need bricks, bro. You got bricks?"
I just started driving Uber while trying to get my stand-up career up and running, so no, I didn't have any bricks. And even if I did, I wouldn't have been sharing them with Hector. And suddenly he's like,
"There's bricks on the roof."
And as he runs out of the apartment and towards the stairwell of the building, I hear these kids shouting from outside the window. Then I look out to see this group of kids, like 11-year-old kids, all shouting stuff in Spanish at our building. They see me, start flipping me off and whatnot before they suddenly scatter in all directions. Then bam. A brick lands right in the spot where they were before they scattered. See, that's the type of guy Hector was. he could go out for a pack of rips and find himself in a brick fight with a bunch of Puerto Rican kids on the way back. Never in my life have I ever had a fight with a preteen, let alone one involving projectiles. But around Hector, that stuff was like a daily occurrence. So come that October, Hector is headed out on some big Halloween tour with one of his bands, and he tells me he won't be back till the second week of November. That meant I'd have to cover half of the rent until then, something I'd have to borrow money to do. This causes a big fight, and for the first time since I moved in, I thought Hector might actually hit me. And being the kind of guy that he was, I knew for a fact that if it came to violence, he wouldn't just stop at one punch. So when the time came for him to go on tour, the mood in the apartment isn't just at its low point. I'm legit scared for my physical safety. He leaves, I'm looking for a new apartment, and life is not so good anymore. So a few nights later, the night before Halloween actually, I'm sitting in the little kitchen area, eating arepas and looking for other apartments. Someone buzzes the apartment, so I go to see who it is. This is back when we had intercoms, but they sucked and barely worked half the time, so when I hear some guy with an accent says something like, "I need an apartment number 3, but the buzzer's not working." I just buzz the guy in without a second thought. New York is a city built on takeout, delivery, and street food, so I'm hardly going to be all suspicious over a delivery driver. But I should have been, and I almost paid with my life for it. Those guys busted our front door open like it was nothing. Just smashed the lock right through with a sledgehammer. I actually thought it was the cops at first because they just piled in, guns drawn, shouting, "Get on the floor, get down." But then the way that they were talking to each other once I was lying face down on the linoleum, that clued me into the fact that they were just stick-up guys. But what were they doing in my apartment? My first thought was, "Jesus Christ, Hector, whose toes do you step on now?" But before I can wonder anymore, one of the guys starts asking me, "Where is it? Where is it?" I'm like, "Where's what?" But that just makes them mad. I get this flurry of kicks that have me balled up in the fetal position, then they ask me again. I can't tell them anything else, so I just say,
I don't know what you're talking about. There's $20 in my wallet, that's all I got on me."
The offer of 20 bucks just offended them, and I get more kicks before they start tossing the apartment like they're looking for something. And when I say tossing, I really do mean trashing. They're deliberately breaking stuff, pulling drawers all the way out and then throwing them at other stuff. It was just destruction in every sense of the word, and it was around then that I got a look at a couple of the guys. They're all messed up or have stuff over their faces. They're wearing all black, gloves and the works. They were professional stick-up guys, probably robbed drug dealers for a living, but Hector wasn't dealing. I mean, I think I'd have noticed at some point. I saw a lot of broken guitars and amplifiers around the apartment, but not too many piles of coke or money. Then right as I'm about to think it, one of the guys comes out with it.
"You sure this is the right place, man?" I don't know. Homie told me he keeps it behind the bathtub sometimes, but these people only got a shower in there."
I feel this wave of relief washing over me. They got the wrong place, so they're gonna just walk out, right? Maybe take my phone so I can't call the cops. So, like I said, I told them my phone was on the table, next to my food, and that I wouldn't call the cops if they just left. Cuck move, maybe, but it's amazing how zen you get about material possessions when you see a Glock in someone's hand. The stick-up guys kind of pause and look at each other. Then right as I think they're about to just leave, one of them says,
"I think you see my face, man, when we were breaking in. He's gotta go."
One of them has the gun, and the guy who wants me dead starts reaching to take it off the guy who has it, but the guy who has it doesn't want to give it up. That was my cue to soil myself and start begging for my life. It wasn't my proudest moment, and peeing my pants was by no means metaphorical, but it is what it is, looking back. They're arguing over shooting me. I'm begging for my life. It's just chaos and them shouting in there, and I'm amazed no one had called the cops already. But then boom. The front entrance of the apartment building slammed shut, and I can hear a very familiar voice coming up the stairs. I'm not even going to type out what Hector was saying. I'd be canceled and deleted from the internet within seconds after posting, but let's just say someone had canceled their tour 3 days in, and he was livid about it. Going on, calling them every name under the sun, ranting and raving as he pounded his way up the stairs, and in the apartment, both me and the stick-up guys are about frozen in anticipation. Then right as Hector is about to come into the apartment, he says something like,
"Hey, I got your money, you whiny little baby. What the f—"
The guy with the gun aims it at Hector as he walks in, looking around at the pure destruction that greeted him.
"Who are you people?"
he screamed.
"Who are you?"
the guy with the gun screamed back. Hector is just gone by this point, foaming at the mouth, looking like he's got one of his eyeballs about to pop when he comes back.
"I live here."
Then, I swear to God, I watch as Hector basically turns into a drunk, slightly overweight Jason Bourne. He swings his backpack off his shoulder and just launches it at the shooter. He knocks the guy slightly off balance, messes up his aim, but by the time he can like rearrange himself, Hector like football tackles this guy onto the carpet and just starts wailing on him. The two other guys then jump in and I'm thinking, "Oh Jesus God, someone's about to get shot." When out of nowhere, Hector comes up and is just windmailing punches at both guys, holding his own until he goes down again. Then almost immediately, both guys start backing up, hands in the air, and there's Hector, holding the gun he'd almost just been shot with, telling both the guys to back up. His face is bleeding, he's totally gassed, but there he is, having just won a freaking fist fight with three guys, one of them armed. He then sits on the KO'd shooter's back, tells the other guys to get out of his apartment, and tells me to dial 911. And only when the cops show up to arrest the guy he'd managed to detain did he realize he'd been stabbed in the shoulder. That night, as he got stitched up at the hospital, I sifted through all the broken and non-broken stuff, swept up all the broken glass and ceramics, and generally tried to put the apartment back in order. He got back at around 1 a.m., still drunk after the doctor told him, "Do not drink on these painkillers," and immediately started complaining about the break-in. I just carried on cleaning up, stopping only briefly to say something deeply heartfelt. "Hector, dude, I just wanted to say I think you might have saved my life today, dude. And I just wanted to say thank you." I felt my throat kind of tighten as I said it, very similar to the way it's doing now as I'm typing this, remembering. Hector looked up at me, with this look in his eyes that almost made it look like I'd gotten through to him, until he replied with,
"Whatever, you could have jumped in at any time."
I didn't mind. I knew Hector well enough by that point to know he wasn't exactly in touch with his feelings. But as he immediately sought to leave the room due to the uncomfortable amount of emotion in the air, he turned and said,
"Did you see the look on those guys' faces, though? It's hilarious, dude."
And he just walked off to his bedroom, laughing that evil toddler laugh that makes my skin crawl, even today. You see, for just over a year, I shared an apartment with the biggest idiot on the face of the earth. And I owe that idiot my life. Please, New York, don't ever change. After I had moved to London, the first flatmate I had legitimately tried to kill me. I think he was only keen for me to move in so I could cover all the rent he was missing. And after a while, petty arguments about cleanliness and money management turned rather vicious, and I was forced to find a new place to live. Once I found a place, I had to wait 2 weeks to move in, and although this definitely wasn't the right move, I thought I'd have to leave it until the last minute to tell my stupid flatmate, because screw you, that's why. And instead of waiting until the day before, I ended up dropping that little tidbit into an argument we had about a week before I was due to move out. He started playing the victim, telling me I was basically condemning him to being homeless, but if it wasn't for his silver spoon up the butt attitude to work, I might have had a bit more sympathy for him. We both smoked and did so in the flat, so the morning after our argument, I wake, roll over, and grab my smokes to light one up in bed before facing the day. Not my proudest habit. I hold my hands up, but smoking in my room was better than facing him in the morning. I pop a ciggy between my lips, grab my lighter, but the bloody flint on the disposable piece of crap is bust. I try time and time again, but nope, it's buggered. So I roll out of bed, walk down the hall towards the kitchen, still trying hopelessly to get a light. Then suddenly, as I stroll into the kitchen, the absolute reek of gas hits me, and just under the humming of traffic outside, I can hear gas leaking out of the stovetop. That freaking psychopath had turned on all the gas in the kitchen, knowing I'd have sparked up first thing, blowing the whole flat sky high. I rush to turn them off, open all the windows in the flat, ran downstairs and called the fire brigade. My flatmate was interviewed under caution, but because they couldn't prove a bloody thing, the police had to let him walk. The landlord was much more understanding though, and we basically made an agreement to cut him out of the lease while we arranged for locks to be changed. Apparently, he'd been looking to get rid of him for quite a while before the incident, so I ended up staying put. The only worry was the ex-flatmate, but since he was under suspicion over what he must have called an accident, I think he was too scared to follow up on it and try for any serious revenge. Still, mess with my head for quite a while after, thinking someone would be that vindictive over me just wanting to move out. Do your research on who you're going to be living with, people. It might just save your life.